Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Geo Patterson. So, Admiral Nathan, you had mentioned that Navy medicine must perform from the sea to the land in the toughest environments and across the spectrum of military mission. But to do it successfully requires a strategic vision and for you to chart a course for your folks, for the folks that support you. Would you outline that strategic vision and briefly describe your core priorities?
Sure. So I think that we've tried to be as concise and succinct as possible with our strategic vision. And it starts with readiness. Readiness is job one for us. As we've talked about before, that's the business I'm in. I'm expected to be able to answer the bell anywhere, anytime around the world. I like to think of us as part of the Navy Marine Corps team as sort of the world's 911. If there's a foreign land or an environment somewhere that gets into trouble, either through a man-made disaster or through a natural disaster, we'd like to believe that we can be on scene very soon. Second is value. And value comes back to the point where we have to constantly be analyzing what we do, how we do it, and how much bang for the buck. I tell my people it's really sort of a fraction described as quality times capability divided by cost. And so what does that mean? That means if I'm doing a certain procedure in a certain hospital, and I do it fairly rarely, but it costs me a pretty penny to do it, as much as I might like being able to have that procedure in my portfolio, does it make more sense to export that to a local hospital nearby? Or do I need that procedure to maintain a skills preservation for my doctors when they go overseas? I have to constantly be analyzing that. Because in the past, I would tell you, when cost was not on the forefront of the military medical leaders, we simply put safety and we put readiness as job one, and we didn't worry too much about the cost. Now we have to evaluate everything we do and look at it from the standpoint of, is it worth it? And whatever we do, we're going to do first class and safely. But let's make sure our portfolio includes only those things that really bring value to our system. And then the third is joint. I need my people to start thinking more and more joint. I'm a believer because of my experience at Walter Reed Bethesda, where we sort of built this, I call it a Reese's peanut butter cup, where one hospital brought the chocolate, the other brought the peanut butter. We put them together, and we have this synergy of best practices that occurred. I've seen the utility and the value of doing things jointly. In addition, it doesn't make good business sense for the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy to have three different medical systems that use three different types of, for instance, IMIT technologies, pharmaceutical systems, education training systems. Why not figure out a way to standardize those, create best practices, share those among the services, reduce redundancies, and create more jointness? Not going as far as the purple suit that some people talk about, which is everybody will just simply wear one uniform and we'll sort of homogenize the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. I think it's critically important we preserve the traditions and the cultural ethos of the services. But we can certainly do that while creating much more alignment and much more joint care.
So, Admiral, what are the guiding principles that frame your command philosophy as?
I tell my people I believe in ship, shipmate, and self. And in the Navy, we say you've got to take care of the ship because if you don't and you lose the ship, nothing else matters. You yourself are now lost and the mission is lost. Mm-hmm. Shipmate, we've got to look after each other. I think one of the reasons I've stayed in the military for a career and I trained in an academic residency, a non-military residency, so I've maintained great friendships with people I trained with, you know, over 30 years ago. But one of the things I've enjoyed is the covenant relationship that we have with our people. The fact that our job is to monitor their health, monitor how their welfare, and to, and some would say intrude when necessary, to help people through situations and take care of them when they're not doing well. And that's a shipmate taking care of a shipmate. And then self, taking care of yourself, raising your hand when you need help. Letting people know if you're not doing well, letting people know if you need help either because of a personal issue or a professional one. You can't handle what you've been asked to do and raise your hand and do it. So I've tried very hard to create a non-stigma guilt-free environment where somebody can raise their hand and say, I need help, where somebody can be constantly vigilant about the people they work around and notice subtle or dramatic changes, and recognize that they have to take care of the mission around them, in this case, the ship, or that might be the Marine unit you're assigned to, or it might be the Naval Hospital you work for.
Admiral, Navy medicine is in the business of force health protection. Would you elaborate on the key components of force health protection and how it relates to force readiness, ensuring your service stays sharp, lean, and ready anytime, anywhere?
It's a great question, Gio. If I were to ask you during, say, in the African conflicts in the desert in North Africa and in parts of the war in the Pacific, in some of the jungles, what a commander feared the most that would impact their mission the most and it would possibly cause them to lose capability to fight, it would not be, the enemy would be high on the list, but it wouldn't be top. Mm-hmm. The top thing would be illness, dysentery, malaria, infectious disease, what's called jungle rot by allowing moisture and fungus and not being able to clean the feet and that sort of thing. Those would bring a unit to its knees much faster than the enemy could. And so our job is to make sure that when somebody goes into a austere environment, a hostile environment, all the way from a humanitarian disaster, which may be an earthquake or a tsunami or a hurricane, to kinetic war, that they go in as protected as possible so that they can be at their peak, they can be on their game, they can concentrate all their facilities on the job at hand. They will have the best equipment to protect the eyes, to protect the ears. They will have the best immunizations to ward off infections. They will have the best ready medical supplies near them to take care of small injuries before they worsen. And they'll have the best major resuscitative equipment to take care of catastrophic injuries and catastrophic illness. One of the great changes that has occurred in combat casualty care is that over the years, if you looked at World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, if you were catastrophically injured in field, the time you were injured to the time you eventually made it back to the States to a tertiary care facility like a Bethesda or a veterans hospital was 45 to 60 days. So we provided care in theater, and we believed in sort of stabilizing in theater before getting back to the States. So 45 to 60 days. In this war, from the average time that you are catastrophically injured until the time you arrive at the bed here at Bethesda is 3 to 5 days. And that has mostly been facilitated by the on-scene resuscitative care and by the great Air Force medical evacuation system, which has these flying ICUs, which can fly the most significantly injured and ill people in the world safely across the ocean.
Admiral, we heard you say one of the greatest honors of being in the Navy medicine is the mission of supporting the Marines on the battlefield. The continuum of care for combat wounded is unprecedented, as you just shared with us, the survivability rate of nearly 97%. Would you elaborate on your efforts to enhance and strengthen the continuum of care for military personnel from point of accession through active service to rehabilitation and transition?
The continuum of care really encompasses what I guess could be described ironically as sort of a ballet or an orchestra of care that is facilitated across the joint spectrum. And so you're injured. Well, here's what's changed. So the corpsman or the medic who's there on scene now has updated tourniquet therapy. They have quick clotting substances they can give. They have body armor, which protects. We have a medical evacuation system, which is highly responsive. And we're very good at getting people within that first 15 minutes to 75 minutes of what we call the platinum slash golden hour of care to a resuscitative station, to where they can be resuscitated, reverse the shock. And that's a ballet of joint forces. For instance, if you look at Bastion in Afghanistan, that is some Air Force, Navy, Army, and British working that facility. And then we have some joint forces in Bagram and in Kandahar and other places. Then once you're stabilized, we get you out of there. The idea is not to hold on to you there. It's not to do definitive care. It's to package you up, get you stabilized, get you to Landstuhl Regional Army Medical Center, where further stabilization is done a little more sophisticated. But again, not definitive therapy, just enough to get you stable for the flight back home. Then the Air Force picks you up and flies you and gets you back to San Diego or Brook Army Hospital or Walter Reed Bethesda. And that's where really I think the military excels from that point, from before that point. And now we get you to a place where you need rehabilitation, prosthetic rehabilitation, and also emotional rehabilitation.
Well, I'd like to go back, Admiral. You had mentioned earlier that the survivability rate, I think we would say upwards of 97%, and it takes folks 3 to 5 days to get to the States for care. But the greater the rates is sort of a double-edged sword because you've got it's a positive, but you're also dealing with folks, as you said, are severely injuries, amputations, and what have you. These create new challenges, and you touched on them, but I'd like for you to elaborate a little bit. What are you doing to address these challenges, and what programs are available?
There's been a tremendous impetus to try to address what I call a sort of a good news problem. The good news meaning that we've had people return from the war. We've had a few soldiers and Marines who returned from the war who have been quadruple amputees. Now, you know, some people have said to me, gosh, you've lost all your limbs. Is that worth it? And my answer is these heroes, they engage with their families. There's new technologies occurring. You may have seen recently there was a double arm transplant at Hopkins. So every day we're learning something new about some of the physically devastating injuries with magnificent prosthetics and with regenerative medicine and with transplant medicine that I think is going to give people their lives back. But that is something that we hadn't seen before because those kinds of injuries wouldn't have survived. And then you get into the traumatic brain injury, which can vary from mild, from just concussion, to the major, to an open head injury, to the post-traumatic stress. And how do we approach that? We're looking very hard at innovative sciences. We've found now that complementary alternative medicine, which when I was in medical school, if somebody had said, we have an acupuncturist here and they want to put some needles in for your headache, I'd say, get out of here. And now when I get a bad headache, where's that needle? We're finding that these kinds of things, biofeedback mechanisms, hypnosis, I'm not saying that's where the center of gravity of the care is, but I'm just saying that we've opened the aperture to any and all possibilities now to find a way ahead for some of these folks. The number one thing we've found, Michael, that has made a difference in our moderate to severe TBI patients and our post-traumatic stress patients is a comprehensive multidisciplinary approach to them, bringing in at the same time not only engaging them but engaging their families as well. Here's what I like to say. I'll illustrate it by example. When I was the commander at Walter Reed Bethesda, I was seeing the new casualties that came in, and we had a young Marine who came in who had lost his leg pretty high up in the leg and part of his hand. His family had arrived because one of the things we do now in combat casualty care is we bring the families in right away. We fly them in the next day. Now, that's good in that they can be there right away, and it's bad because they haven't really had time to adjust to what they've heard. And so I walk in, and this Marine was fine. He'd lost a leg, and he was newly arrived, and he was excited about going to the operating room and getting the touch-up changes and getting into the prosthetic rehabilitation. And he had his young son with him, who looked like 5 or 6, and he had his wife with him. And his son was saying in the course of the conversation, who was a little bit bewildered by all this, I guess they had planned to go to Disney World at the end of the tour when he was coming home. But he came home early, of course, and now with an amputation. And his son said, Daddy, are we still going to go to Disney World? And so the Marine sort of saddened up and teared up a little bit, and his wife teared up a little bit because they didn't know what to say to the little boy looking at this missing leg and everything. And I said, well, when are you going? And he said, well, we're supposed to go when I got back. That was about 8 months from now. And I said, yeah. He said, you're going to go. I said, 8 or 9 months? I said, we'll have you up. We'll have you walking. I said, not only will your dad take you to Disney World, he'll take you on every ride. And the little boy brightened up, the wife brightened up, and the Marine sort of beckoned me to him, and I bent down. I said, you know, I'm not making this up. He said, it's not that, sir. He said, I didn't like those rides to begin with. So my point is that he will engage with his family again, And yes, he'll have some – and I'm not trivializing his injury, but he will be able to play catch with his son and laugh with his son and roll around on the floor with his son and carry his son on his back in a piggyback ride. If he had moderate to severe traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress, I couldn't make that promise to him because that can take the whole family with it. The whole family can be consumed by the altered affect and personality and challenges of that. And so we really are looking at ways to engage the family and the wounded warrior at the same time or the injured person at the same time through a lot of modalities, using more sophisticated sensors, more sophisticated therapies, using much more alternative therapies.
How is the continuum of care for military personnel being enhanced and strengthened? We will ask Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.